Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another Books with Hooks. Carly, will you kick us off with the first query letter?
Dear Carly, Cece, and Bianca, thank you for the valued insights and resources your show offers to emerging writers of all genres. Since listening to your podcast, I have revisited my query letter and opening pages based on the helpful advice you've shared. Dear Judy is an 81,000-word literary novel about James Morris, a 29-year-old architect, grappling with childhood trauma and the magnetic drag performer who helps him find a path towards healing. In the spirit of Kate Elizabeth Russell's My Dark Vanessa, the story unfolds through chapters alternating between 2015 New York City and the Rhode Island seaside village of James's childhood. James is a pensive and introverted narrator who recounts a complex web of interconnected characters with overlapping stories. Imagine Ocean Vuong's voice with the Leanne Moriarty plot. For years, James has kept silent about a sexual encounter he witnessed in middle school between his 40-year-old music teacher, Ray Bradburn, and his classmate, David Lopez. James's silence was born of the fear of not being believed and the shame around his own intimate relationship with Mr. Bradburn. Guilt surfaces later when James realizes that Ray is free and clear to commit the same atrocities again, all because he never spoke up. Well into adulthood, James is emotionally stunted and unable to connect or trust other men. His hesitance extends to his career. A talented architect, James cannot find fulfillment in his chosen vocation. Everything changes when James stumbles into a drag show and meets Judy Dear, a New York City premier Judy Garland impersonator. Judy and James have electric chemistry. Their new friendship sparks memories of his relationship with Ray and the love they once shared for the real Hollywood legend. All the while, James holds on to the inside information about a threat to Judy's nightlife existence. His client, Russian steel magnate Alexander Petrovich, has plans to acquire the bar where Judy performs and combine it with two adjacent townhouses into a gaudy Manhattan mega mansion. Since James is conditioned to respond to any conflict with shame and secrecy, he conceals this information from Judy. When James discovered Judy Deer's true identity, his world begins to further unravel, and he is forced to confront secrets from his past and present. No longer a silent observer, James must face the painful memories that have haunted him for nearly 20 years, this time not alone, but with an ally. Judy Deer is my first novel. Practicing architect, my writing has been featured in trade publications in the design and construction industry, including Faith and Form, the Interfaith Journal on Religion, Art, and Architecture. I have developed this manuscript in several workshop courses in New York City, with continued editorial input from former instructors and writing colleagues. Judy Deer examines the nuances and complicated emotions surrounding trauma while offering a unique perspective on the role artistic expression can play in the process of recovery. I wholeheartedly believe this story has the potential to help anyone who has struggled with emotions of ambiguity, guilt, and shame. Mixed in with the book's more serious themes are moments of laughter, joy, and show-stopping performances. Thank you for your time and continued dedication to the craft. Sincerely, Robbie.
Awesome, Carly. Wow, that sounds really intriguing. A bit lengthy in terms of a query letter, but certainly very intriguing. What was your take on it?
All right. So, Judy Deer, this is a really, really lovely kind of overall concept. I think there's just so much heart here, the balance of the kind of like theatrical elements with obviously the kind of the traumatic plot here that we're working through. So from a query letter perspective, I think ultimately we're starting off a little bit vague about the actual hook here. So I know it's literary fiction, so we don't need this kind of like burn it all down kind of hook, but we still kind of know what's at stake here, right? So, and I think we kind of get to it at the end, we understand what's at stake is that his friend's livelihood, you know, the place where they perform and make money, right, is going to be kind of torn down, right? So I think in the end, we actually do understand the stakes. But at the beginning, it says, grappling with childhood trauma and the magnetic drag performer who helps him find a path towards healing. And the towards healing bit is such a passive stake, right? It's such a passive goal where I think I would really like to know a bit more at the top about, again, what's at stake for this friendship. And I think that that's really what I would like to know a little bit more at the top. But I think the comp is really strong, very accurate here. Comparing yourself to Ocean Vuong, like that's a comparison. I don't know how many awards Ocean has won. I think National Book Award is one of them, right? So you're telling us that you take yourself to be a very serious literary writer. And obviously we hope that is true, but yeah, that's a big one. Overall, it's a very intense query letter, but it's also quite long, as Bianca was getting, right? So the things I think we can cut, I made a note here of what I think we can cut. The part, well into adulthood, James is emotionally stunted and unable to connect or trust other men. His hesitance extends towards his career. A talented architect, James cannot find fulfillment in his chosen vocation. That's two full lines that really could have been summarized in a couple words. That's an example of something I think we should cut. The next part I think we should condense is we really need to shorten this last body paragraph about the Russian steel magnet. I don't think it's important to know his name. I think you could just say like a work conflict leads towards this, that, and the other, right? So I think we're just too many details. It reads very much like a synopsis, this part, when we really just need to understand this is what's at stake, right? And for a literary novel to have something at stake, that's great, right? So I'm happy that we have something at stake here. So really just trying to condense this and focus on what's at stake is important. I would also cut the pretty much the last paragraph. So the Judy Deer examines the nuances and complicated emotions surrounding trauma paragraph. It's just one of those things where you don't need to tell me. I totally got that from the query letter itself. I think you did a great job expressing that. And when I read the pages, I will get that. So that's just an example of absolutely don't need that paragraph whatsoever. Not that it's badly written. It's just, well, we don't need it, right? I think your writing is going to do the work here. So I think our goal really is just to condense, and get to what's at stake earlier.
Great, Carly. Thank you. All right. Will you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages and then your take on them?
All right. So we start with our timestamp, New York City, 2015. We have a little kind of, I wouldn't call it a prologue, but kind of just like an offset paragraph about kind of setting us up for the world of meeting Judy Deer, talking about the importance of Judy Garland in our character's life and just that importance. Then we jump to talking about work. So we're talking about AutoCAD and kind of, you know, we're in the architectural firm, learning a little bit about his work day. He glances at the screen. It's 2:00. He decides he's going to take his lunch break and pop onto his personal kind of email and computer where he starts to get into a dating app. And we know that it is for guys. So a guy to guy website, and he's interacting with another guy. They have a pun about Liza Minnelli, and they're kind of like just joking about that in their little banter on their app. And then we get into a work scenario where he is being called into a meeting, and we kind of get into some architecture jargon and that sort of thing. And we get into some references about how architecture is like music and art. And we're getting into our intersectionality of art forms between architecture, art, and music.
Awesome, Carly. Okay, what was your take on those pages?
All right, so I think I didn't mind this kind of offset opening paragraph where we're kind of like learning about how important Judy Garland is to our character. What I would work on is rhetorical questions. They're really creeping up a lot, not only in this paragraph, but kind of throughout these pages. I made a note in my personal notes here that you will get sent to you about exactly where those are, but there's just really something to pay attention to there. The other thing I think I would be working on is the technical elements. So we start off, again, this is all on the first page. We start off with explaining how we use AutoCAD. And AutoCAD is something that designers use and architects use. It's very technical, and engineers use very technical software. And we're doing a lot of technical speak here throughout whenever we're talking about the architecture. And it just creates a bit of a barrier between the writing and the reader and the character and the reader, when really I think just being in scene a bit more when we move in, I would just move into that meeting faster. I think that would help. But also the way that the people in the office are talking about architecture, we're just, I think the intersection, as I mentioned, between the music and the art and architecture, we have so many references that I just felt so taken out of the moment, because unless you get every single reference, like, is the reader going to have to run to Wikipedia to kind of look up some of these references? Some of them we're going to know, some of them we won't. And some of them you kind of over-explained, like the Stevie Nicks stuff. You were getting at a really specific point about Stevie Nicks that you wanted to make. And so you spent a whole paragraph kind of like breaking down how to get to that point. Like, you're kind of explaining your own jokes. And in literary fiction, we kind of want to make sure that the reader gets the joke right away. Not that it's a joke, but you know what I mean? Like that the reader gets exactly what you're trying to express right away without having to explain yourself, right? It's like kind of like a magician doing their trick and then like, and then afterwards explaining how you did the trick, you know, to be like, look how smart I am. I believe that we can get there. And I think literary fiction requires a lot of confidence in your own writing and a lot of confidence in your reader that they are going to understand exactly what you're getting at. However, I just think we have too many references between all of these different art forms to really have the reader feel connected to this actual moment. And being in scene is so important. I know Cece talks a lot about being in scene. And I think this would benefit from really focusing on why does the reader have to be in this scene? Not just what you're trying to show us as, you know, the creator of this world, but really like, how are you going to engage this reader and get them turning the pages from a plot point of view? So leaning into your scene here from a reader's perspective, I think would really help.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Remember, for our Ko-fi supporters, those of you who support us monthly, you will get to see Carly and Cece's detailed notes on all four queries that we're looking at today. And for those of you who support us monthly, you'll get to see two of them. All right, Cece, let's go to your query. Will you read that for us?
Dear Cece Lira, I am writing to you because I heard you on the podcast, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, express an interest in feminist family dramas and stories involving intersectionality. I am seeking representation for American Exodus, a completed work of women's fiction, 81,000 words. Like the televised miniseries, The Plot Against America, based on Philip Roth's novel, the story shows a slowly declining democracy driving a family apart, but with the contemporary feminist feel of The Husbands by Chandler Baker. The story is told from the perspective of a middle-aged mother of three, with a few chapters written from the point of view of her family. Dr. Susan Levin lives according to social convention. When a populist government advocates replacement theory and shutters kosher butchers, it's scary and unfair, but what can she do? She is busy. She must publish to be promoted. Her eldest is getting married. And the high school is threatening to expel her youngest again. Soon, ethnic quotas result in her son's expulsion from university, and the administration removes ethnic minorities from the voting rolls. As civil society unravels, so do family relations. her new son-in-law works for the administration, while her youngest gets in trouble with the law fighting it. With her husband in a paralyzing depression and the Canadian border closed to refugees, she follows her sister-in-law to Israel, leaving her eldest behind. Once in Jerusalem, her husband and son fit in, but Sue and her daughter struggle with the edicts of a newly elected patriarchal government. Now there is no place to go. If Sue is to find the sense of belonging she craves, she must give up her conformist tendencies and fight to create the world she wants to live in. I have written two nonfiction books, one of which is Woman for President, second edition, University of Illinois Press. A former reporter and university writing instructor, today I run exchange programs that give me an international perspective on families and threats to democracy. This is my debut novel. I appreciate your time in considering my query. Best, Erica Falk.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. Wow, that sounds really intriguing as well. What was your take on that?
I absolutely agree. This is a super intriguing query letter. The comps did exactly what comps are supposed to do for the emotional purposes, which is tell me, oh my God, I know what the story is, right? When you say plot against America meets the husbands, I get it. Like, I get what the story's supposed to feel like. I get what I'm going into. If I'm in the mood for that kind of story, I'm going to immediately dive in. So it sounds really incredible. I also want to say that I can tell just by how well structured this query letter is that the writer spent a lot of time working on it, and I so appreciate it. It's very, very polished, and you should be very proud. I do think it needs work, specifically in the plot paragraph. There's a lot of plot points, which would actually be fine because I didn't even notice it the first time I read it. I was just so intrigued by the story. So you can keep the plot points if you want, or you can compress to be a little bit more conservative in your approach in case an agent does mind a little bit of a lengthier plot paragraph. But the one thing that I do think needs work is the last line. If Sue is to find the sense of belonging she craves, she must give up her conformist tendencies and fight to create the world she wants to live in. This is, like, great job with the setup, inciting incident, plot points, but the climax is reading a little vague and too interior for such a plot-driven novel, right? I would prefer to reach this point with a very clear major dramatic question that is specific to the protagonist's plot journey. So find the sense of belonging, that's too interior. Also not what's going on. You've described to me a situation in which it's not just about a sense of belonging, although that's very important. There are exterior things going on, right? So I would just reframe that last line. Does she join the resistance? As she joins the resistance, does she find herself with conflicting loyalties? Like, I don't know what happens. It's your book. But whatever happens, this last line cannot be this interior if this is to be such a plot-driven novel. I also really liked the author paragraph, so great job with that, and thank you for sharing.
Great, Cece. Okay, what was in those opening pages, and did they do the heavy lifting?
So we are in Dr. Sue Levin's point of view. The query letter made that clear, that it's told through her point of view, with a few chapters on her family as well. And, you know, she's with her husband, her daughter, and her daughter's fiance. They are leaving the inaugural ball. They're going to a bonfire. The bonfire is essentially, there's the Clark President anthem playing in the background. Everyone is so happy about the first woman president. The protagonist was involved in the campaign. Her husband was, her son-in-law apparently too. It's one of those situations where they're all happy. They're toasting. And then a book is burned. And then, in the middle of the speech, an anti-Semitic comment is mentioned. And her husband goes pale. Her husband removes everyone from there. They just say, come on, let's go, let's go, let's go. And they're in the car and talking about how they're really surprised about this anti-Semitic comment and how this could be indicative of something worse. So that's what happens.
And what did you think about it?
Okay, so like I said, the concept here, very strong. I do think the execution needs a little bit of work. I want to start off by saying something that's working really well. There are some really great sharp visuals here. So for example, her daughter's round, soft baby cheeks still pad her face, obscuring her hard ambition. That's a wonderful sharp visual. Excellent job there. And there are so many others here. I do think that the interiority is what's not working because you're promising me that I'm going to be in her point of view. And yet, For example, when the anti-Semitic super scary comment is said, the first thing we see is Dan goes pale. Her first reaction, her body, the fear in her body, should be the first thing she clocks. Not Dan goes pale. Dan goes pale comes second. And then we do get her interiority after Dan going pale. So the order is wrong, but it's not just a matter of what order is or isn't right, according to my opinion. It's also things like there's borderline head hopping going on. There are moments where she narrates what someone else is doing with their intention. There's no way she could know that, even if she strongly believes the phrasing needs to be a little bit different. And also, there's not enough fear and even surprise, honestly. Surprise, I think, should come first. She works for this candidate. She had no idea this person was anti-Semitic. So where's the surprise? Where's the confusion? Where's the wait, what? There has to be a little bit of that. And I also think one of the functions of interiority is time travel. If you're at a rally and someone says an anti-Semitic comment, someone you trusted, your brain is automatically going to go, wait, so that day last July when he said that, is that what he meant? Or, but wait a second, how could he think that? Because last July he said something pro-Israel, right? That's what your brain does. And a few lines on that would make her interiority so much more believable. As well, another interiority note, I wanted to see how she observed her daughter and her fiancé, because her daughter is very much saying, no, they're not being anti-Semitic. You know, it's okay to be against Israel's policies. That doesn't make you anti-Semitic. And the parents are disagreeing, or mostly the husband, but also the protagonist. But I wanted to get more insight because moms don't just listen to their daughters disagree with them and think, oh, well, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to cause a fight. Moms theorize. They go, she's saying this because she wants to impress her fiance, or she's saying this because she went to that liberal school. I should never have put her in that liberal school. Or she's saying this because of whatever, whatever the reason. Again, you will connect things. That's what our brain does. And I wanted more of that. So, you know, big picture notes, ground this in Sue's interiority, remove the borderline head hopping. I did flag that for you. Make sure that you're talking about her thoughts and feelings first in a way that's very specific, not generic. And as a second minor note, the dialogue is a little forced right now. It's a little unnatural. It's being used to impart information. And naturally, all authors use dialogue to impart information, but the reader is not supposed to feel like it. To use Carly's great analogy, it's supposed to be like a magic trick, right? I'm supposed to see the magic trick and be mesmerized. I'm not supposed to see what's happening behind the scenes. So yeah, those are my notes.
Great, Cece. Thank you. All right, Carly, let's go to your second query letter. Will you read that for us?
Dear Ms. Murray, Ms. Lyra, and Ms. Waters, an avid listener of the Shit Podcast, I hope my book is acceptable. My hook lures you and my cook leaves you scanning for the pages. I'm seeking representation for my dual point of view 82,000 word contemporary drama. Eyes Watching is best described as Nicholas Sparks's safe haven meets the Loch Ness Monster. Technology and folklore clash, fueling a mind game. Lacey's adult existence has mirrored a bad soap opera. Married young and now divorced, she is compelled to rebuild a life for her and her dog. She must rediscover her strong, independent, confident self. It's time to pull on her big girl pants and move out of her best friend's home, but that won't be easy when the feeling of being watched slithers through her veins, keeping her paranoid. Just when life swung in a positive direction and Kent enters her life, disaster erupted. Lacey's future happiness was ripped from her grasp. Young and impressionable, Wesley believed he was stuck in a marriage rut and craved the social scene. Now in his mid-50s, he's terrified of being alone during his senior years. Thanks to the tracker he installed in Lacey's car, he knew she did not have a social life. He assumed she would crawl back to him, but his hopes to reconcile faded as he watched her entertain another guy. When Lacey refuses his invitation for date night, his temper flared. Ignoring the rumors about a mythological creature that existed within depths, Wesley dismissed the golden rule, certain it was folklore meant to attract tourists. He ventured into a perilous territory, putting lives at risk. I have worked with editors, and I spend time watching Readsy videos, attempting to hone my craft. Another contemporary drama is in the final stages of editing. An animal lover, our 15-year-old dog, loves her daily nature walks, unless she isn't in the mood. She plants her paws firmly on the ground, turns her head, and gives us that rebellious eye. She's the boss, and she knows it. No animals were harmed while drafting this plot. I'd be thrilled to send my complete manuscript upon request. Thank you for your time and consideration, Heath.
Wonderful, Carly. Okay, what was your take on that?
All right, so I feel like the Nicholas Sparks safe haven comp works here. I do think that works. However, the Loch Ness Monster bit, that confused me quite a bit, I will say. I don't know if it was meant to make me think more like Scotland or more like actual Loch Ness Monster, but I also don't know exactly where we are physically, whether we are supposed to be thinking there is a Loch Ness Monster type of situation nearby. So I had a lot of questions about that. And then there was a log line saying technology and folklore clash, fueling a mind game. But I just wasn't sure how fantastical we were supposed to be because it's pitched as a contemporary drama, right? And so, yeah, I just had a lot of questions about the positioning and exactly who it was for. But I would lean more into the safe haven comp. I think that's more accurate. And I would cut that log line. And now I just definitely think we need to do some condensing. There's some lines here where essentially we're saying the same thing, right? She wants to rebuild a life for her and her dog, must discover her strong self, put on her big girl pants. Like all of those are really saying the exact same thing. So I would just, again, either cut most of it or just find a way to condense this as much as possible. I like the little line about slithers through her veins, keeping her paranoid, that feeling of being watched. I think that's good. But I'm also kind of curious to know if this is suspense or thriller or mystery. Like, we have contemporary drama, but the word drama is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. Like, what kind of drama are we talking about? Sometimes when I hear contemporary drama, I think one of those novels about like family drama, right? It's like there's a family secret type of drama, right? But this is like drama, like danger drama. And I think I just want to have a sense of like how dangerous this is, because Safe Haven does have a very dangerous ending. So again, that's why I think this is a good comp, but I almost feel like, again, that positioning, contemporary drama, isn't as accurate as I want it to be. So the next question is, who is Kent? At first I was like, is Kent the ex? Who is Kent? Is Kent the new guy? You kind of have to explain, you know, her new boyfriend. And if he does need to be named, fine, call him the new boyfriend. But if he doesn't need to be named, maybe just say like, she got a new boyfriend. And then this bit about her future happiness was ripped from her grasp. I'm like, okay, just a little bit vague. Like, we kind of spent that whole paragraph normalizing that she has to rebuild her life. It just felt like too much. Okay, so next, I struggled a little bit with his POV, Wesley here. So this is really, really tough if we are going to spend half the novel in his POV, which I kind of get the sense because you pitched it as a dual POV. Is the reader going to really want to read this dark side? Essentially, you know, if this novel is 82,000 words and it's a dual POV, we're spending approximately 40,000 words with this character. If he is a manipulative asshole, like, I just don't know how on earth we are going to convince readers that they need to spend time with him. Like, does he have any redeeming qualities? You'll get a bit more, listeners, you're going to get a little bit more once we get into these pages. But my questions at this stage are, is he redeeming at all? There's a novel called All Things Cease to Appear. It's one of my favorite literary thrillers. Absolutely obsessed with it. And it has a huge POV in this kind of manipulative male POV, but it's a literary thriller, right? And this is contemporary drama, a bit more commercial. So I'm just not convinced a commercial audience is going to want to spend this much time with an asshole. I don't know. I'd love to be proven wrong. I'm just not fully convinced. And then we get into our bio paragraph. I will say, just from like a technical point of view, the line that says, an animal lover, our 15-year-old dog loves her daily nature walks. It sounds like the dog is an animal lover, like, because there's no mention of a human in that line. So it kind of just sounds like your 15-year-old dog also loves other animals. So I don't know. I would reword that a bit. And I know Cece loves being extra about dogs, but I feel like we're just a little bit extra about dogs in this one. So I would take it or leave it on that last bit about the dogs.
I think that was definitely for Cece's sake, and probably they wouldn't do that for other agents. Something interesting, and I've had this discussion with students in my classes, when we talk about, yeah, but look at Joe from Caroline Kepnes's You. He's a sociopath, he's a psychopath, he's a murderer, etc. But he was a damn charming murderer. We were sucked into how much we kind of liked him and how much he made sense in terms of his social commentary. He hated the same kind of people most people hate, and hate of pretension, etc., etc. And so we got on board with him, and it was only like later that we found out, okay, this guy's a complete psychopath, and then we still liked spending time with him. So there's a fine line between a charming psychopath whose head we like being in and someone who's just an asshole and we just like, I don't like this person.
There's that whole angel of death thing, right? There's like a whole genre, right? Where it's like you're killing in the name of good, kind of, which I think we thought maybe Joe was like that at the beginning, which is why we were slightly endeared to him. But yeah, I think that's so, I mean, that's one example of hundreds or thousands of manuscripts, right? Like, there is a reason You was a best-selling book and a TV show, right?
Yeah, because she did it so damn well. Okay, so what was in those opening pages, Carly?
All right, so we start with a prologue and we meet Wesley. And so we are with him in a parking lot. He is observing a building. We know that he is watching his ex-wife at work. It's all kind of a setting thing where we're like getting the creepy vibe. He's kind of like staking out. He's looking at his watch. He finds her car and we get the sense that he is planting this tracking device. And so he breaks into the car. It happens to be unlocked, breaks into the car and spends a bit of time being kind of like technically kind of taking apart some of the dashboard to kind of set up this tracking device. And so we learn a little bit of his interiority, but mostly we're kind of getting this job done and that's it.
Okay. And what was your take on them?
So I really loved the writing in terms of the setting. I thought this was so well written. We really know where we are. You know, there's a lot of little examples just about exactly what the building looked like, how many stories it was, like how tall it was, what the trees were like, what he was wearing. But it wasn't in an overwritten way. It was just like such a perceptive way of writing that I really, really liked it. I just thought the setting work was really, really well done. A small note here, he touched the rim of his Toronto Blue Jays baseball cap and you put the little like R for registered beside Toronto Blue Jays. You don't need to do that. It's totally fine. Take that out. We don't need that. It's just a teeny bit distracting. And another thing in that same sentence you said, and adjusted his designer sunglasses. If somebody knew exactly what type of baseball cap they were wearing and they didn't know exactly what type of designer sunglasses they were wearing, that was a bit of a red flag to me. Like if this guy is so like kind of pretentious, just thinks he's just the king of the situation, a manipulative guy who's like paying attention to what he's wearing, there's no way he wouldn't be saying like my Tom Ford sunglasses, you know what I mean? So I just thought that was another opportunity just to lean into that a little bit more. I thought the fact that the car was open was a little bit too easy. Even if it's like he tries one door and the one door is locked and then he goes to the second door and that door is open, just like ratcheting up that tension just a little bit, I think would be great. Just a little bit too easy that he was able to kind of get in there. I made a note about something that I thought was like very creepy, but very good. He said, the weight of her engagement ring and wedding band pulled from the gold chain beneath his work shirt. So like he had her old like rings on around his neck from his ex-wife, right? I thought that was like, oh, that's creepy. That's a good little character insight. But yeah, I think I have a lot of questions about this book as a whole, as I said, about how much time we're spending with Wesley, especially since we opened the novel with Wesley. I don't know. There's a lot to be discovered, I think, in general about this concept, I think, and its saleability, in my personal opinion. But on a line level, as I said, the setting writing here was so, so good.
Amazing, Carly. Thank you. And I'm always saying that if the writing's there on the line level, other things can easily be changed. They can easily be adjusted. But if the writing isn't there on a line level, then you're going to be struggling. So that's great feedback. Okay, we are now moving on to the last query letter. Cece, will you read that for us?
Dear Bianca, Cece, and Carly, I started listening to the Shit No One Tells You About Writing podcast in the beginning stages of this story 2 years ago. Your podcast has been the steady drumbeat in the background over this time, and I'm very grateful for the lessons and laughs. I'm excited to share this submission with Cece because of her interest in family stories, which runs through the heart of this novel. Exposure Therapy is a contemporary romance complete at 80,000 words. This novel is for fans of plus-sized heroines and unconventional heroes and combines the lifestyle reporting world from How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days with the second chance travels of People We Meet on Vacation to follow two ex-somethings writing a story about a road trip. Norma Mitchell is a clickbait copywriter who desperately wants to be the real writer her late mother believed her to be. When she accidentally submits a personal letter from her therapy session instead of her latest pitch, she gets the opportunity she's been waiting for and winds up face-to-face with a situationship that leaves her burned. Oliver Nader, a burnt-out lawyer, has spent the last decade bending under the weight of his family's expectation. Now he's getting a fresh start doing one thing he never let himself pursue, photography. When Noma's pitch upends his plan to secure his new job, he'll do whatever it takes to avoid going back to late nights and complicated briefs. between hikes, horseback rides, and an opportunity for second chances on themselves and each other, Noma and Oliver make their way across the country in pursuit of a story that could change their lives. Before long, both find that the closer they get to finishing their trip, the less either of them wants it to end. In my 9-to-5, I'm a digital strategist working towards gender and racial equity, with a focus on reaching young women voters via the internet. In my early morning and evening hours, I strive to write happy endings and love stories for characters, which the world sometimes compels to live in the margins. Thank you for your consideration, Tessa.
Okay, thanks, Cece. What did you think of that?
Okay, I really, really like what I think you're going for based on my interpretation. Because when I read How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, I thought, oh, it's one of those romance comedy things where someone is trying to achieve one goal and then in the journey to achieving that goal finds out that they want something else and it's going to be sweet and heartwarming. And I love those concepts, right? I think they're so much fun. But you did write the lifestyle reporting world from How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And I'm thinking, wait, is the lifestyle reporting world the only thing about this comp that's going to work? Because if it is, I would just find a more recent comp with lifestyle reporting. There's so many. I just don't. Because How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days tells me something else. It gives me that mood. And I really like that idea if that's what you're going for. I also really like the inciting incident when she accidentally submits a personal letter from her therapy session instead of her latest pitch. That is so great. Made me think of that shopaholic inciting incident that I watched in the movie a million years ago, but it was so funny and just working really well. I do think, however, that the last line of the plot paragraph, before long, both find that the closer they get to finishing the trip, the less either of them want it to end. This, for my taste, tells me that it's really sweet and so wholesome and adorable, but not as climactic as I need it to be. It's not even a major dramatic question, right? Because it almost feels like a sweet ending. I think that in a rom-com, the will they or won't they is definitely part of the driving force, but we also need something else. We need something at stake. Now, that being said, take this with a grain of salt. I love rom-coms that have that climactic feel. I am not a fan of the nothing happens in rom-com situation. Like, I think they're boring. So if your book is more like it's going to be sweet and wholesome and adorable and it's not going to be the thing with the huge stakes, then don't listen to me. But if you were going for something more like, no, I want more things to be at stake. I want it to be that more meaty sort of rom-com. Then I think that line needs to be tweaked to really flesh out the major dramatic question and not at all their interiority or their love for each other, because that's just understood.
Could you give us an example there, Cece, of the major dramatic question that it could be and how you might incorporate that? Because I'm thinking a practical example here would be really helpful for the rest of our listeners.
Yeah, so a really good example is Beach Read. Not only do we have the will they or won't they, but we have her going through her discovery of her father's longtime affair, which is way more complicated than it seems, and the fact that she has to deliver a book. And so they create a competition where she will write his book and he will write her book. And so that makes their will they or won't they complicated on many levels. She's working through her stuff with her own family. She's working through her career moments. He's working through his career moments. There's a neighbor element. So I think that to me would make more sense here. So I don't know what the major dramatic question would obviously be for your story because I don't know enough about it. But anything that lies at the intersection of conflict between love and trust works. All good stories, literally all of them under the sun. There is no exception to this. They exist at the intersection of conflicts between love and trust. So wherever your conflict lies, I would just flesh that out.
Amazing, Cece. Thank you. I feel like we have another saying that's about to go onto a mug. Okay, so will you give us an understanding of what's in those opening pages?
So we start with a very, very brief text exchange that happened 4 months ago via what I'm assuming is a dating app between Noma and Oliver. It's quirky and it's very short. And then we get to Noma's point of view, interiority. She's thinking to herself that you only need to try something once to know if it's going to work. And anyone who keeps trying something over and over again and expecting different results, they are the definition of insanity. And because of this truth, this universal truth, as she perceives it, she knows she is not meant to write clickbait because it's like the 2000th time she's done this, probably more than that. Then she logs off from work and gets a call from her best friend And her best friend's like, where are you? You're running late. If you run late, you're going to have to buy me lunch. And she says, well, no, I'm going to be there right on time. We understand that she needs to clock in to her work as a barista. So she goes to the cafe. And at the cafe, we get a little bit of description of what it looks like and her relationship with her best friend who also works there. And she gets a notification on her phone. It was a reminder for submissions, and it's submissions for something that she really wants, the Lifestyle magazine. So she very quickly writes up an email. We see her writing the email. We see her attaching a file, and she submits. So that's what happens.
Wonderful. Thank you. What did you think about that?
So I want to say that the text messages in the beginning working so well. It's short. It's quirky. It's not info dumpy. It's just excellent. Please keep that. The interiority in the beginning, I would not keep. First of all, I don't agree. The whole, you only need to try something once to see if it works. Neuroscience doesn't agree with that. So maybe she's meant to be incorrect about this. Maybe this is her character's path. And at the end, she'll be like, oh no, I realize that that's not how things work. But even if that's the case, I wouldn't start with it. It's just too interior. And I wanted to see her, I think, having a goal, a clear goal in a scene, because there's absolutely no goal that she has throughout these five pages. So I wouldn't start with that. I think you're starting at the wrong place. Even the call with her best friend, it's so polished and so well written. So like, brava in terms of the writing, but like, there's no purpose to her actions other than establishing things. We've established that she works at a 9-to-5 sort of job in copywriting and like clickbait writing. We've established that she has another job as a barista. We've established that she has a best friend. And to be super clear, we've established this really well. Good job. But again, I don't want just establishing. I want to see her like interact with people. So maybe like a scene where she is dealing with a difficult boss, because I know she has a difficult boss based on a reference. But that's just my take, right? Like, so I do think it's starting in the incorrect place, just in terms of tweaking. I really think it's just about adding a goal. I really like how sure of herself she is. There was an echo that I highlighted, life-changing, worth every penny. That's dialogue. And then interiority. It was a lot of pennies. That echo is working so well. There were so many things that I liked, like these, the symbolism with like the half, the glasses half full that she leaves lying about. I really like how the inciting incident was framed. It was very believable, so tight, polished scene. So you do have something that's really strong here. So yeah, big picture notes. Don't start with interiority in the beginning. Give her a goal. While the writing is strong, I'm not rooting for her. And I suspect that that's because of the goal. I think rethink the setup. And then as a final note, and I don't mean to take over, but I personally felt that you're missing an opportunity to comment on the millennial gig economy. The fact that she essentially has two jobs. She has to work as a barista and she has to work as a clickbait writer, her words. This is super common, right? Like, this is the world we live in. And I just felt like some interiority with a sense of emotion about how she feels about that would be so great. And some contrast perhaps with her best friend, right? Like, maybe her best friend feels the opposite way because contrast is super important to flesh out story. So I would, again, if this fits your character, if this is something that you would like to do, this is by no means something that I am saying you must, right? It's just like, I read this and I was like, oh, opportunity for social commentary here. Like one line, one zingy line about that. I would really, really like that. And I think that agents and acquisitions editors would really like that too, because your writing is strong. So you have something here that could be really special, I think.
Thanks so much, Cece. Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of agents and editors out there who are also millennials, right? Who are coming up through the ranks and who are going to connect with that kind of social commentary. I think that's a great suggestion. And also for our listeners, remember that when it comes to setup, the challenge there is to include that in the action of the story. If you're able to give the reader some understanding of what the context is and what this world kind of looks like while things are actually happening and moving the plot forward, then you've really nailed it. So try as much as possible to integrate those two aspects of storytelling. Now we go to today's guest.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app. And it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them. And that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users in 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then with phrases and then sentences, and it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there. I am going to introduce an author whose debut novel has rocked my world. In reading her pages, I saw my own family. I saw my sister. I saw my cousins. I saw my mom. I saw my aunt. I saw my grandma. It's just such a beautiful, beautiful novel that's fun and at the same time introspective. And the themes make you think, but you only realize that you're thinking after you've had fun. So truly, it's a masterclass in storytelling. I highly encourage everyone to read. But let me read you her bio so you know who I'm talking about. Because if you follow me on social media, you probably have a good idea. Claire Jimenez is a Puerto Rican writer who grew up in Brooklyn and Staten Island. She is the author of the short story collection Staten Island Stories, which received the 2019 Hornblower Award for a first book from the New York Society Library and was named a finalist for the International Latino Book Awards, a New York Public Library favorite book about New York, and Best Latino Book of 2019 by NBC News. She received her MFA from Vanderbilt University and her PhD from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. In 2020, she co-founded the Puerto Rican Literature Project, a digital archive. Currently, she is an assistant professor of English and African American Studies at the University of South Carolina. Her fiction, essays, and reviews have appeared in Remezcla, Afro-Hispanic Review, Pank, The Rumpus, and Eater, among other publications. What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez is her debut novel, and in case you couldn't tell, one of my many obsessions. It's for sure in my top 10 all-time favorite novels. Welcome. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Claire. Hello, Claire. How are you?
Oh, my God. Thank you so much, Cece. That is so wonderful and so kind. Thank you. I'm good. I'm tired. I was saying, my toddler is up at 5 a.m, so I'm struggling a little bit, but I am. This re-energized me, and it's so wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, my gosh, Claire. Thank you for being here. We are so happy. And I wanted to start the interview by asking you, I want to ask you about your inspiration for Ruthie. But before I do that, I feel like it's fair to say that there are three pivotal moments in an author's career. Maybe there's more,
But like for the purposes of our podcast, I'm thinking about these three. The first is the day you decide that you want to make this a career, this being writing. A lot of writers are typically like, oh, I love writing, I love reading, but the decision to make it a career, to pursue it as a career, is a pivotal moment. The second moment is when you land an agent, and the third moment is when you get your book deal. Like, can you take us back to the pivotal moment of each of these three big milestones in your career?
This is such a great question and one that nobody has asked before, but I think you're right. Like, I think I always, like as a kid, I always loved writing. I always knew that that was something I was going to do, whether or not it was a career or not. But when I kind of made the choice to pursue it, it was after I had graduated from college, from undergrad with my bachelor's. And I was working a lot of terrible jobs, much like Nina. I worked at a Victoria's Secrets at the Staten Island Mall. I was working at a swimsuit shop, you know, uptown in New York. And then I eventually was working in all of these different like nonprofits trying to put together, you know, money. And I kind of was just in a spot where I wasn't happy. This was around 2008, and I kind of tapped out and decided, okay, I want to change this. And I started to look up MFA programs, and I applied to get in. And the first, and I think this is maybe something that's useful to some of the listeners who are maybe just starting out. The first year I applied to MFA programs, I didn't get into a single one. And it was devastating. And I remember calling one of my professors, Emma Perez, who taught me my first Latino Lit class at Colby College. And, you know, I was just like crying, and she was like, Claire, listen, you just got to get back to it, you know? And so I went and I applied the next year, and then I got into a few different places, including Vanderbilt, you know? So that's kind of a lesson in terms of, you know, you don't stop, right? And so I got into Vanderbilt, and that really changed everything for me in terms of creating a pathway for me to really consider writing as, you know, as a career, as something that I could do. And so that was when I kind of decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do, right? And then the agent, yes. Oh, man. Let's see. So after I got out of the MFA program, I returned back to New York. I was adjuncting. I was doing a lot of different jobs, but I didn't really get much momentum in terms of finding an agent. You know, it took many years. I also didn't have a novel. I had short stories I was working on, but I didn't have a novel. And that was really what folks were looking for. And it wasn't until I went back to school, I kind of tapped out again from, you know, working all of these different jobs in New York. And I got into the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, which has a great program where, you know, basically you can focus on creative writing in addition to whatever you're studying, whatever focus you take in the PhD program. And so I was able to take a lot of workshops, and I had a teacher, John Asagi, who was like, listen, you know, I think this is a novel. The short story that became What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez, it was originally called Catfight. And I started working on it and developing it. And then they had an event, much like the one I want to invite you to, Cece, where we brought in agents. Well, we didn't. The professors did, right? They brought in agents to meet the students, look at some of their work, do a panel, talk to them. And I was lucky enough to meet Jane Von Maren there. And she read Catfight and loved it. And she was like, I want this, you know, like, I want to work on this with you. And it took some time. You know, I kept on developing different drafts of the novel, and we bounced back and forth. And then a few years later, we went out. And so that was a wonderful moment. As soon as it went out, it was snatched up within a month, I think. It went very fast. It's so interesting because, you know, you take so much time writing, and that takes so long. And then when it gets picked up, and, you know, you're just moving. And so that was a wonderful moment. I was also pregnant when it got acquired. So I was also dealing with, you know, like, I'm going to have my first child, and I'm pregnant, and I'm tired, and my book just got acquired, and now I'm doing drafts. So it was a very busy time. And I was also graduating from my PhD program and on the job, on the market, looking for a job. And so, yeah, so those were the three pivotal moments that you talked about. I think you're right. I think that those are really key.
I love that so much. Thank you for sharing. And I love that Jane worked on this so many times with you, right? Like, it's a true testament to what a great agent she clearly is. I don't know her. Hi, Jane, if you're listening, but you're clearly a great agent. But the fact that it got picked up really fast is rare. Like, I have had lots of projects that got picked up fast, but I have had even more projects that just took a long time to sell. Because everything in this industry, it's like publishing is trying to play this game of how slow do you think time can move? Ha! I will show you how slow it can be every single time, and I will surprise you by being even slower. So it's amazing. You know, right? Like, you're nodding. So, okay, you know.
Yeah. From talking to friends, you know, and I don't think this will happen every time for me. As you're already familiar with, you know, publishing, I think, is a combination of hard work and also being at the right place at the right time. One of my professors years ago was like, that's why it's always important to show up, right? Like, because you don't know what the right place will be or the right time, you know? And yeah, having a great agent who, you know, is championing the work. So yeah, because I know that it's sometimes things, very good projects, and it's not a testament to the actual work, sometimes get caught in limbo, yeah, which I'm hearing is happening a lot more after the pandemic.
Yeah, things got slower. Things got slower for sure. I think it's wonderful that you have this amazing success story. And I very much wanted to always be fast for you, because why not? There have to be the outliers. It can be you. You write amazing books. So we want more amazing books by you. So speaking of books, the premise of What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez is, you know, for any of our listeners who have not read it, and I very much want to avoid spoilers, but I also want to talk about the book. So it's about a Puerto Rican family living in Staten Island. And so this is a family of three sisters, but one of the sisters, at the start of the story, this is not a spoiler, has disappeared. She disappeared back when she was a teenager. And so we get the other two sisters' points of view, that's Nina and Jessica, and we also get their mom's point of view, that's Dolores. But also weirdly, and again, this is not a spoiler, we do get the missing sister's point of view. And that's Ruthie. It's in the title, What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez. But they see this, one of the sisters sees a girl who looks exactly like their long lost sister on a reality TV show called Catfight, which now I get is the title of the short story, which is really cool and meta. And you know, it's the search for Ruthie. Is this person really Ruthie? Are they going to reunite with their sister? What happened to their sister? Like, these are all important questions that the novel revolves around. And that is so interesting. So based on that amazing premise, which I love so much, and I'm so excited you wrote this novel, I will say that for me, your novel is a relationship-driven story. It does have a very clear plot hook, which is great. Like, I love plot. Plot's amazing. But it is a relationship-driven story. It is the fact that these two sisters are so different, Nina and Jessica, like so different. The fact that the mom is even more different. The fact that even like the characters who don't get a point of view, right? Like the mom's best friend and the coworkers at Mariposas. Like, we have so much relationship drama in the best way possible. It really sets the stage for important conversations, for cultural criticism, and just for plain good old fun. Like, it was just really interesting. My question is, did you set out to write a relationship-driven story? Is that like what you're drawn to? Or did you kind of like do it and then realize that that's what you're doing? I'm wondering how intentional it was. And also, in writing these POVs, did you have a favorite? My favorite was Nina, I'm not going to lie. Although I loved everyone. But like Nina, I don't know if it's because she was first. Like, we got her point of view first. I don't know what it is. But like Nina, I identify more with, I think. But how was it? How was writing so many different voices?
So I'm always thinking about voice when I begin. That's usually, you know, right now I'm working on another novel and I'm, you know, still figuring out the voice. And so when I can't figure out the voice, I kind of get stuck, right? So I would have to say that I think it is character and relationships that I start with, you know, and then from there thinking about like, what are the tiny mysteries within ourselves, within our relationships, within how we think about each other, how we move around each other, you know, what are the disappearances in our lives besides like actual literal disappearances, right? You know, what are the ways in which we might feel like we're disappearing, you know, even when we're there, like even thinking about Nina and this PWI, this predominantly white institution, you know, what are ways in which she's seen or not seen? And so from there, you know, I'm very interested in mystery, although I don't think that this is a mystery with a capital M. I think it borrows from certain elements and thinking about questions and how those drive these women throughout their lives and how they interact with each other. But, it, you know, mysteries with the capital M have certain beats you have to hit. And I'm more interested, I think, in, like you said, the relationship between these women. And writing in terms of the different points of view, you know, it's interesting because I felt like very, you know, from when I decided to make this a novel, it was right away I thought that decided that it was going to be a multi point of view novel. Like I just knew that I wanted it to be this chorus of these women's voices that are kind of rotating around each other, that are building upon each other, and that they're accumulating much in the same way that we think maybe of music, right? And are these stories, you know, in harmony with each other, and when are they dissonant? And so that was framed the way I was thinking about this novel in terms of those voices, organizing those voices together. In terms of favorite point of view, you know, it's hard because I think like each character had fun moments to write, you know? So like, you know, when Dolores is at the church and she's cursing folks out, you know, that was fun, right? It was fun to get in there and play with that. But Dolores's voice was also very hard for me to write because it's one that, you know, Dolores is somebody who grew up partially in Puerto Rico, right? And she's of a different generation than I am. And so I had to really work hard to catch that character. Nina's came easier for me to write, you know, because she's closer to my experiences. I worked retail, you know, I went to PWI. Although we're very different, she's the baby sister, I'm the older sister, you know what I mean? So I want my characters to be their own people, right? And to have their own destiny. And so at times Nina's character was easy to write when I was like, oh, these are experiences I understand and know. And at times they were hard, you know, because Nina can kind of get inside herself sometimes, and which is good at moments, but can kind of drag the plot a little bit. So I had to go back and fix her to sort of balance that interiority with the present action. And Jess's hospital scenes were really fun to write, you know? So I'd have to say, it's hard to pick one that's favorite. You know, I do have to say, like, one character that was ultimate fun to write all the time was Irene. And she doesn't have a point of view chapter. I loved writing Irene. I was like, I knew right away I wanted her to be a trickster. And every time she showed up in the novel, I wanted her to like provide some type of relief almost in the plot.
I love that. I vote that you write a short story spinoff from Irene's point of view, because I would love to get in her head. She is so much fun. And I hadn't thought about it, but yes, she does offer relief. Because let's face it, this book deals with some big, difficult themes, but it's funny. Like, it makes you think, it makes you laugh, it makes you feel. It really straddles that really impossible line that I'm sure all authors want to. It just gives you all the emotions. The range is really amazing. And a huge part of that are the POV characters, but part of that too is also a fun character like Irene. So I think that's just a really smart technique that our listeners can perhaps take draw inspiration from, because it does seem interesting to me. So you mentioned Jessica's hospital scenes. So what I love is that Nina and Jessica are really different and they're really close, but at the same time, they have like lots of messy emotions between them. Like Nina's so resentful of the fact that Jess thinks she's like automatically in charge because she's older. Jess, to a degree, and like fair, but also not fair. Like, it's like Nina doesn't know things. Like, and I'm the eldest too. So I get that dynamic fairly well from the eldest point of view. But what I love is how Jessica is, like, they're all very self-aware. Jessica is very clear on, like, the fact that she doesn't mess around when it comes to money, responsibility. Like, she's just someone who's on top of things, which is why she's so, people like take advantage of her in her job, because she's the one who actually gets things done. Whereas Nina's self-awareness, it shines through in various moments, but there's one moment that she is thinking to herself, because again, she's so cerebral, but she's thinking, I found out that my biggest weakness would always be my anxiety, and how that would like paralyze me and make me overthink. And like, as someone with anxiety, I very much relate to that. And with Dolores, I think that a really cool thing about her point of view is how she was always talking to God. Like, it wasn't properly a prayer, because it's very much traditional prose, but there is that voiciness of dear Lord. And she's also contemplating, like, I used to have power with my daughters. Now I don't anymore. They don't respect me, which is something that happens when children grow up, but especially children of immigrants, because you grew up, I'm saying this from my own experience, I guess, you grew up being more fluent in a language that's essential in a country that your parents don't speak as well. And so you feel like you have more power, which is kind of messes with their heads, I think. But, you know, like all things in good and bad ways. But I guess my question is, how did you go about developing these women? Like, you've developed incredibly rich women with self-awareness who are really different, and their voices are really different. For example, Dolores talking to God, was that always there, or did you like infuse that later?
Yeah, so Dolores, as I mentioned earlier, she was the hardest, you know, perspective to nail. At one point, I had a fellowship at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. And while at Centro, they also have an archive, like a physical archive, you know, that you can go into, and also a digital archive where they had these oral histories. And they were interviewing folks of Dolores's generation, right, who came to the States. And so I spent a lot of time listening to these people talk, to the rhythms in their voices, to what was, you know, prevalent, what were themes that surfaced. And I also, before my grandmother passed, I had interviewed my grandmother and my mother just for myself, so I could have these histories that I could pass on to my son. And I was thinking about, as I was listening to them, I would hear certain tics in the way my grandmother spoke. For example, my grandmother was the type of woman who punctuated a lot of, you know, a lot of her sentences with chacho, right? And originally when I had Dolores's, you know, section, it didn't have any of this, right? I was like, oh no, I got to go back. I got to add the chachos. I got to get this, you know. And so you're really, I think it's an exercise in listening. Writing is, right? And across the board. And the more you listen to the world and notice the world, the richer the writing will be. And so that's kind of how I went about Dolores's perspective. For, you know, Nina and Jessica, kind of the defining characteristics that shape their voice. I thought a lot about eldest and baby, right? You know, like, and the guilt that motivated a lot of Jessica's telling, right? And the silences that exist within her point of view, and her frustration and her exhaustion. In fact, I asked for the novel back. I gave birth after I'd submitted what was supposed to be like the last revisions on this novel. And then I gave birth, and after a few weeks of not sleeping, I was like, Seema, my wonderful editor, Seema Mahani, and I said, Seema, I need the pages back. I was like, Jessica's not tired enough. This isn't working, you know. And I went back and I put that inside of her point of view. And then for Nina, Nina is somebody who I feel like is really disillusioned by like all these narratives that were fed her since she was a child, right? Like, you go to school, you know, you get a degree, you'll get a great job. And it's like, okay, I did all of the things you told me to, and I'm here selling panties at the Staten Island Mall, you know? And so that lens really filtered how she saw the world and how, what words I chose to describe what was going on, you know? And so I think it's constantly going back to who is this character, and that'll shape the voice.
I love that so much. I hope everyone listening is taking note, because first, that is a brilliant line, which we must use as a pull quote on social media, that writing is listening. But also, you just gave examples of listening to the world at large when you did archival research, to your family when you interviewed your grandma and your mom, and to yourself when you listened to your own exhaustion as a new mother, and how that would for sure reflect in Jessica's character. So there's so many layers to the listening, and that is excellent advice. Thank you so much for sharing that, Claire. Like, I really have to take some time and think about this, because it's just so interesting what you're saying. I want to pivot a little bit and ask you about the business of being an author. We at the podcast, we try to be really transparent and share like how hard it is to sell copies, how hard it is to really move books. I think of publishing as kind of like a really cool nightclub. And I know this is going to sound strange, but hear me out. So you're outside the nightclub, right? And the nightclub is like the music coming from it, you can barely hear it, but it just sounds so amazing. And the energy is amazing. And everyone going in is amazing. And you want to go in too, but you can't. You're on the outside. But then you do get in after a long time. And once you're in there, you're like so happy. But then you realize that even though the nightclub is awesome, there's actually a VIP room in the back. And that's where the cool kids are, right? Like, it's cordoned off by this little rope. It's velvety rope. And you can see it, but you can't be there. And then you go into the VIP room after many, many years of trying. But once you're inside the VIP room, actually, there's a secret room behind a bookcase. You can't even see this one. And that's where the really, really, really cool kids are. And you can see where I'm going with this, right? Like, at every stage, there's a secret room that's even cooler and even harder to get in. And the metaphor being, of course, breaking into publishing, getting an agent, getting a book deal, becoming a bestseller, having your material optioned, being able to publish more books, which is also a huge thing and hard to do. I'm rambling, but I guess what I'm trying to say is how much of the publishing industry, the business side of it, did you know before you joined? Because I know you have, obviously you have an MFA, but I don't know how much of the business side your MFA actually covered. What was surprising to you? What are some things you wish you knew about the business side that you're like, oh man, I wish someone had told me XYZ. And maybe it's not as bad as I'm describing. Maybe I'm being like doomsday here. And please be honest, like we want to know your wisdom.
Oh man. Yeah, this is such a great question because I think that, so my MFA at Vanderbilt University, oh, this was many years ago. Clearly, I think it's probably like when I entered, it was probably like 15 years ago, but I had great professors who really like focused on the page. And, you know, I think that they were very conscious of like protecting that time so that you can, you know, just be yourself and write the stories that you need to write, right? Which is great. But then I graduated and I knew nothing about getting an agent. I had these stories, no way, you know, and so I'm like, I'm back in New York, I'm adjuncting, I have these short stories and I don't know what to do with them, you know, like I'm like reading these articles in Publishers Weekly and like how to get an agent, reading and trying to look through this database and send out queries. I've never sent a query out. Like we didn't have, you know, at Vanderbilt, like, okay, here's a class about how to send a query out to an agent. And as you know it, because you have this podcast, that's so important. And so it was kind of like this crash course, I feel like. And this is something that I want, because now that I'm a professor and I'm at the University of South Carolina, as I was mentioning before, Cece, like, I want to introduce my students to, you know, okay, here are agents, you know, this is what they have to say about publishing. Here are some editors, you know, how do I write a query letter? How do I be a good writer? Like how to be a conscientious writer who is kind and professional and doesn't, you know, put their foot in their mouth when they're working with editors and agents. You know, for example, when I brought in I did a virtual panel with some agents last year and for the SAS academic year. And one of the questions that the students had was like, what are your pet peeves? And they were like, oh, so many, you know, but that's important, right? That's important things for writers to know, because they may not realize that, you know, what they're doing is rubbing somebody the wrong way and everybody's sending a manuscript. And some of these slush piles, you know, you got hundreds of manuscripts. And so how do you make sure that yours stands out? So all of these things, that's a very long way of saying that all of these things are important. And I think that in addition to, yes, I want emerging writers to have that time to really just focus on the story without focusing on selling. But eventually by the third year, I want to have them thinking about that because I want them to go out into the world with tools to pave a way for them to become published.
And so if you could go back and tell yourself something, what would it be? Like what word of wisdom? Or maybe you wouldn't say anything because you don't want to ruin the time-space continuum. But what would you say?
Oh, man. Write more, read more. I would have just gone back and written. I think I was still, when I was in my MFA program, I was still developing a like sort of writing schedule or practice. You know, I wasn't very disciplined. I think discipline is something like, I'm not very disciplined now still, but I have to force myself, you know, to, okay, do this, do that. But I think about like, oh, especially now that I have a baby, I'm like, damn, I had so much time to write in my 20s. I could have been doing that instead of going to that damn party, you know, like, and reading, you know, It pains me, Cece. I don't know if you've ever had this feeling that like there's so many good books in the world. And I know that when I pass, I will not have read all of the good books in the world. And it's like a very geeky sadness that emerges sometimes.
I feel it all the time, but maybe, and this is strange for me because I'm not typically an optimistic person, but I frame it in my head, like my brain just frames it as, yay, there are so many books, because it's what I love doing with my life. I say to people all the time, I have no life by choice. This is not a sad thing, people. This is by choice. I don't like doing any of the cool kid things. People are always talking about cool things. I think that's awesome. I'm like, yeah, you do those cool things. Run that marathon, climb that mountain, travel to this, you know, place in the world. That seems awesome. I'm going to be home reading my book, eating my cookies, because it's the coolest thing to do. Because I don't know, like maybe I just read better than other people. Maybe maybe I'm weird and climbing a mountain doesn't seem that fun, but it is the coolest thing to do. And so the fact that I will always have a book, like no matter what happens in my life, no matter how hard it gets, days where I want to strangle publishers, those days happen a lot, unfortunately, I always have books. And I'm so happy about that. So anyway, I see it as a wonderful thing. Although I'm sure that as I'm getting older, I'll probably be like, what? There will be no time, especially because new books are always coming out. But I will leave the nihilism for another day. I wanted to ask you about something that surprised you in the process. Like, what about becoming a published author was very surprising to you, both in a good way and in a bad way? Like, what was the thing you were like, oh, I didn't know that was a good thing? Or maybe like, oh, that was a bad thing.
Oh, man. I think how kind of exhausting it could be, you know, because you think from the outside, you're like, damn, I can't wait till this happens. And I'm going to go on my and visit all these bookstores and, you know, do these readings. And I'm going to do all these interviews and all of this stuff. And it's something I should know because like Nina, I am a very anxious person and struggle with anxiety. But you're managing when your book comes out, especially if it's your first book, like maybe in a big five. I had a collection of short stories before, but it was a university press, so there was a lot less publicity. I don't know. So getting a book out of Grand Central, there was a lot, all of a sudden the book was everywhere, right? It was in airports and it was in L or it was in, you know, and you, it's exciting, but you also, it's like for somebody who has anxiety, it is so nerve-wracking. So that surprised me. And I think I had to learn ways to manage that, but also the kindness of kind of just looking away, and doing something for yourself and constantly focusing on what you love about that. You know, like, I mean, I love getting on an airplane and experience turbulence, but I love meeting a reader, like another Latina who's like, this is my story, Claire, like this, that's my mother, you know, and that for me is worth all of it.
I love that so much. And on that note, I'm wondering if I could have your permission to read a line from your book that I highlighted and I've mentioned it to multiple people. And I talked to my own mother about it, my sister about it, my husband about it. So I'm not going to ruin the story, but again, everyone already knows that they are looking for Ruthie. Like, is this person on this reality TV show Ruthie or not? You're going to have to read to find out. But the two sisters, Jessica and Nina, they keep the fact that they potentially found Ruthie a secret from their mom. I think maybe because they think their mom can't handle it. You know, these are two sisters protecting their mom, and the act of protecting someone can be a beautiful thing, but it could also be something else. And I'll read the line before saying more. Here it goes. Quote, "There was something embarrassing about this that I couldn't quite put my finger on. It felt like my mother was rehearsing a scene from Law and Order, as if she were some type of private investigator. And for a moment, I had to interrogate why I was so embarrassed by this, my mother acting as an authority. Could this be some type of internalized colonialism? Wasn't she, after all, the utmost authority on Ruthie? Didn't she literally make her?" End quote. So to me, like, as I was saying, protecting someone can be a beautiful, kind thing. It can also be infantilizing. And the power imbalance between the child of immigrants and the immigrants, the parents, is a complicated power imbalance. You have so many cultural things that go into it, but the language itself does play a huge part because language is a form of currency and currency is a form of power. When you wrote that, did you realize what you were writing? Did you realize that you would be like rocking readers' worlds? Because I have since shared this with so many people and everyone comes back to me with chills about this line without me prompting them. Like, I just say, read this book, let's talk about it. And did you know? Like, are you just magic? Like,
oh my God, Cece, you're so kind. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I've mentioned this before, but like growing up in the 90s, there were not books by like Puerto Ricans or even Latinos that were like really featured. You walk into B. Dalton's or Walden Books. I mean, these are stores that no longer exist right now, but like you didn't see these books, right? And I think I always craved to have some type of mirror. You know, I don't always need to read a book that mirrors my life, but you need like one, right? Like you need something, you know? And I had some experiences like that with like writers like Judith Ortiz Coffer, or Pedro Pietri, you know, or Alvarez, or, you know, like where you have these glimmers of like, oh, I can see that. And so when I was writing, it's almost like you're trying, I forget who says this and I should know it. But just like you're trying to write the book that doesn't exist. And for me, it was like capturing this experience of being, you know, of the diaspora, being Puerto Rican, of being a girl, right? And then a young woman and in a society in which we are vulnerable in so many ways. And so it is an honor, you know, to hear that that struck you, because that's always what we want. So much of being a writer is working in the dark for like a decade and then getting the book out there. And then you don't know if it's going to hit somebody or if people are just going to be like, eh, or laugh, you know? And so like to hear that it resonated is everything. Thank you.
There were so many more. There was Nina's anxiety, the doorman commentary. I'm not going to ruin it. Everyone go read the book. But given the how much I love your book and how everyone loves your book and people who haven't read it will love it, what are you working on next? What can you share? Give us something.
Yeah, so I'm working on, it's a novel with mystery elements again, and it's about motherhood. And so it's about motherhood, friendship, you know, daughters, and also like daughters becoming mothers, you know? And so it's back in Staten Island. It's back in the 90s. That's what I can give you. I'm still working through a lot of things. This time I think it's going to be actually a single narrator. And so I'm working through that voice right now. Yeah. So that's where it is. I'm hoping it will take off.
I hope so too. I hope you can find the voice. I applaud you for taking the time to crack that voice, because I know from working with my clients, once you have that voice, it's not that everything else is easy. Nothing in this industry is easy, but it's doable. You know, if you have the voice, you can figure everything else out. So another question I wanted to ask you, and it's always like the last question I ask of everyone, it's, would you recommend us a book? It can be a book that you have read and loved. It could be a book that you have read and you have mixed feelings about. Or it could be a book that you haven't read yet, but that's on your TBR and you're very excited. This is your opportunity to pay it forward and share a book, because you know, in publishing, we might all wear different hats and be in different places and not necessarily work together, but we are, I firmly believe, we are all in this together as publishing people.
So I stopped because I was looking through my Kindle, and I have like a hard copies, physical copies too, but I'm not allowed to buy any more books because there's no room for them right now. But I'm reading so much at the same time. But I also want to, you know, give love to folks who may not, you know, have as much publicity. So I'm looking at some of the books I have now. Actually, let's go with...
If you need to plug in more than one, that's okay. When I asked this question of Jennifer Close, she was like, here's seven. So it's anything you want.
Okay, so always Jennifer Mercer McCauley, she came out with a book the same year that mine came out, When Trying to Return Home. Black Puerto Rican writer, so smart. She's a poet as well. And so all of that is inside of the sentences. I love it. Let's see who else. Malcolm Friend, who's a poet as well. And he has a collection, Our Bruises Kept Singing Purple. And that's one that I actually taught last year. And I just got this. I'm looking around because I actually have the physical copy. I'm realizing Kwame Das's Sturge Town. And he's another poet. As you can tell, I read a lot of poetry too, you know, and I think poetry is really great to help you think about precision, especially precision of the sentence or the line, right? And to sharpen your image and also for voice.
Thank you so much, Claire, for joining us. It was truly a pleasure. Thank you for writing What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez. Please write more. Please, your fans need more books by you. We're very excited to see what you do next.
Oh my God. Thank you so much, Cece. This is a pleasure. This podcast is a gem. And so I am very, you know, honored and happy to be here.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.